topic is a very broad one, so I'll try to cover some of the issues. I won't be able to cover all of the issues. The famous big issue began in the 1700s. The Gemara Masechet Shabbos says that there are 39 malachas on Shabbos. So one of the prohibited activities on Shabbos is you're not allowed to shecht an animal, you're not allowed to kill an animal, you're not allowed to kill a human being on the weekdays either. Let's say someone deserves the death penalty, you're not permitted to give him the death penalty on Shabbos because it's a malacha of netilas neshama. Shochet is one of the malachas. So the Gemara says that everything is learned out from the Mishkan. All of the activities that were necessary, all the important activities that were necessary for the construction of the Mishkan are considered malachas. So they used to shecht big animals in order to get to hide. Or they shechted the animals. So the Gemara says, we learn out from the Mishkan, only if you kill such a big animal. But if you kill a tiny little kina, a louse, so the Gemara says, it's permissible to kill lice on Shabbos, because that's not similar to the animals that they shechted when they needed to build the Mishkan. Why is it not similar? And what way is not similar? Because these lice are spontaneously generated. It comes from perspiration. When people perspire and you have dirt from their face. So that's not similar to the behemoths. The behemoths that they used to shecht for the Mishkan, those were born from other behemoths. They were born from other behemoths all the way back to Sheshes Meibereshes. And these lice are spontaneously generated. So therefore, it's not similar to the behemoths. So there's no prohibition of netilas neshama. So in the 1700s, I think Louis Pasteur proved that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. So it posed a big problem. There's no such thing as an animal that comes from schmutz. It has to come from an egg, from a previous animal. So how do you deal with the Gemara? So that's when the Jews started writing encyclopedias. In the 1700s, we have quite a few encyclopedias then. The Chidor was writing and the Yad Malachi was writing. So we have the Pachad Yitzchok, Rabbi Yitzchok Lamprenti. So he has in his encyclopedia quite a few volumes. He has in his encyclopedia a whole essay about this. He asked his Rabbeim, how do you deal with this Gemara? Should we still observe this din in the Gemara? That it's still muta laharakina, now that we came to the realization, science came to the realization that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation. So the Rabbanim said, they think the din still applies. Maybe there's a different explanation to the Gemara. Maybe the Gemara had a tradition that this is the din, and the reason that they gave was incorrect reason. Maybe it's a different reason. We don't know, but we assume that the din is still true, that it's still mutar laharog kino. The Rambam has an original interpretation of the Gemara. The Gemara says that sometimes if you eat certain treif of fish, you get five times malchus, four times malchus, five times malchus, six times malchus. So what kind of an animal is it? What kind of a treif of fish is it? Sometimes when we go to a wedding, so some of the rabbanim are questioning whether the hashgacha is reliable, so instead of fleish, they'd rather take fish. So Rabbi Tendler is always touchy about the tuna fish. So he says, I wouldn't recommend to eat the fish. If it's treif of fish, you get six times malchus. If it's treif of fleish, you only get one time malchus. Treif of fish is worse than treif of fleish. He'll always give that line, sharp line. So the Rambam disagrees with all the other commentaries on the Gemara. How do you calculate? How do you come up with six times malchus? So Rashi and Taisus and the Ramban and the Ga'onim, they all learned that the pasuk is repeated many times in Chumash and says the same thing four times. So you get four times malchus even though you're violating the same avera. According to how many times it's repeated, that's how many times you get malchus. And the Rambam makes a big fuss about this. That's kefil halav. So the Rambam says it's only counted once in the minyan mitzvahs. If it's a repeat of the exact same lav, you don't get four times malchus, and it doesn't count as four lavim. It's a repeated for emphasis. But you don't count it as four avers. You don't get four times malchus. So what does the Gemara say? You get four times malchus, five times malchus, six times malchus. So the Rambam has an original interpretation. He says if it's a sheretz ha'of, if it's a bird that flies and it's not kosher, that's one malchus. And if it's a fish that's stray for fish, let's say an eagle is an unkosher bird, so you get malchus. And if it's a stray for fish, then you get once malchus. And if it's a stray for animal that's not malager, mafis parsa, then you get one malchus. What happens if it flies and it swims and it crawls on the ground? It's all three together. So it's three different things. So you get three times malchus. That's what the Gemara means. The Ravid writes on the Rambam, the Ravid is making fun of the Rambam, so he calls him the collector. Hama'asif hazeh, osef dvarm she'enam. He says he collected animals that don't exist. He says there is no such animal that it flies and it swims and it plays the piano also, and it dances also, it does everything. There is no such thing. That's how the Rambam interpreted the Gemara, that the animal flies and it swims and it crawls on the ground. And then he says, so those are three times Malkus. And then there's a fourth time Malkus. He quotes a passage from the Torah's Kohanim, from the Sifra, and he interprets it to mean an animal that's spontaneously generated is Nocha Malkus. That's another love. Flying is one love, and swimming is one love, and crawling on the ground is the third love, and spontaneously generated. So this is the way the Rambam writes in the Mishnah Torah, as well as in the Sefer HaMitzvahs. Then in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, he has a whole paragraph. Usually in the Sefer HaMitzvahs, he just gives you a description, a brief description of the mitzvah. Here he adds on a whole paragraph. He says, and those people who think that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation, they don't know the ABC of science. Everybody knows, every scientist knows that there is such a thing as spontaneous generation. So the Rabbanim were very upset when Louis Pasteur came up with this chiddush, that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. So they were very upset. What are you going to do with the Rambam? The Rambam interprets the Gemara that there is. So a couple of years went by, and communism became powerful. the communists don't believe in a Borei Olam. That's a Shita, they're atheists. So if there's no such thing as spontaneous generation, so who created the first animal? If there's no spontaneous generation, you have to believe in God. That God created the first animal, and every animal gave birth to another animal. But if you're an atheist, you have to believe in spontaneous generation. So the communists commissioned their scientists to disprove Louis Pasteur. So for money you can do everything. So they took the money and they gave scientific proof that Pasteur is wrong, that there can be spontaneous generation. So many Rabbanim were dancing from joy. They finally saved the Rambam. Finally saved the Rambam. That the scientists disproved Louis Pasteur. So I remember when I was in college, so I took chemistry for the non-science majors. And my professor was Professor Shmuel Soloveitchik. That was Rav Soloveitchik's brother. So he was telling us the whole history, the whole Hishtal Shalus Hadvarim. So he says, Anoch and Vei, that the Rambam is saved by the Apikursim, by the atheists. The atheists have to disprove Louis Pasteur, because if you don't believe in God, so who created the first Baal Chai? So we're going to listen to them to save the Rambam. That's ridiculous. We don't believe in spontaneous generation. We accept Louis Pasteur. The question, how do you deal with this halacha? So many of you may be familiar with Reb Mendel Kasha's Torah Shlema. He did so much research, he used to work so much on Kisvei Yad, and he wrote so much. I didn't know him personally. Some of you must have known him personally. I didn't know him personally. My impression always was, he was a modern thinker, a modern man. He worked so much on manuscripts, and he tries to show different shitas. He doesn't always like to be traditional. He tries to come up with new ideas. So I was so stunned to see. He has an essay about this also. He has a whole volume. He has several volumes on Divrei Menachem, I think it's called. Very nice, Divrei Torah, on Shulchan Aruch. And then he has a long section on the Lamates of his Malachas. And when he talks about the Malach of Shochet, so he discusses this section in the Pachad Yitzchak, in Rabbi Yitzchak Lamprenti's encyclopedia. So he says, and he feels that the scientists are wrong, that there is such a thing as spontaneous generation. We don't accept Louis Pasteur. I don't know, I thought that was a little odd that one should assume like that. It's usually assumed, the Pashup Shat anymore, is usually assumed, like the Aruch HaShulchan writes, that whenever you drink a cup of water, whenever you breathe in, so there are millions and billions of microscopic bacteria that he's swallowing. So how can you drink anything? You're swallowing all of these shiratzim. So the answer is, whatever is invisible. The Torah never prohibited invisible bugs. It doesn't mean that if you close your eyes and you don't see it, that you're allowed to eat the shiratzim. If they're visible, you close your eyes. That's not called invisible. But if they're microscopic bugs, that's what he writes. If you use a microscope. So the same over here. It's not visible to the naked eye that the lice are born from eggs. It looks as if they're spontaneously generated. So that's usually assumed to be the pshat and the gemara. Since it's not visible to the naked eye, it's microscopic, so that's considered as if, the halacha considers it, as if it's spontaneously generated, and that's mutam. That's usually assumed to be the pshat in the Gemara in Chulin also. The Gemara in Chulin, the end of Perik Eletrefis, the third Perik, talks about worms that you find in a fish. So the last year and a half, they're tumbling about the worms in the fish. So the Gemara says that the worms in the fish are mutter. The Gemara says worms in the fish are mutter. The Jews always ate herring, and the herring always has worms in it. So even the Rabbanim who came out in Eretz Yisrael asring all the fish in the world, but herring they can't answer. Herring is mutter, because the Jews always ate herring. So what's the difference? These worms are holier than the other worms. They're all the same worms. So the Gemara sounds like it says, the simple translation of the words in the Gemara sounds like it says that the worms in the kosher fish are mutter because they develop from the flesh of the fish. Since it's a kosher fish, so if you chop it up and you add the flavoring, whatever, you cook it, so whatever, fish is fish. So since the flesh of the fish turned into worms, so that's why it's mutter. So we know that there is no such thing. The flesh of the fish doesn't turn into worms in order to have a worm. You have to have eggs from a worm there that hatch and they develop into worms. So how can the Gemara say that the worms are mutter? So the Rabbanim said that we pagina dibura, we accept half of what the scientists say and the other half we don't accept. So the scientists tell us that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation, that all the worms have to come from eggs. That's against the Talmud, so that's apikursis, so that we don't accept. But the science tells us that all of the worms and all the fish that we're eating are from the outside, so that we do accept from them. So all the fish are, all the worms and the fish are also, because we rely on what the scientists tell us, that all the worms came from the outside. I think Morris says that the worms and the fish are mutter. Those are the other worms and the other fish that we don't have those worms today. Only the holy worms in the days of the Gemara, they had such worms that were spontaneously generated that the flesh of the fish turned into worms. It's a little ridiculous if you ask me. What do you mean? In the days of the Gemara, there was spontaneous generation. So those worms are mutter. And the herring, the worms in the herring, those are spontaneously generated from the herring. And all the other fish, everything is awesome. It's ridiculous. It's usually assumed to me that when, again, Reb Shlomo Zalman wrote an essay about this. They asked Reb Moshe Feinstein about this. What's the din? Now that the scientists proved no such thing as spontaneous generation, no such thing that the flesh of the fish turns into worms, so do we still are we still permitted to follow that din in the Gemara, that you're allowed to eat the fish that has worms in it? So Reb Moshe Feinstein said yes. So they asked him to write a tshuva. So he said, what are you going to write a tshuva? I look like a baby. I look like an idiot. You write a tshuva. If there's a shaila, there's a black and white din in the Shulchan Aruch. What is there to discuss? So because he didn't want to write a tshuva, so that's why people say, Reb Moshe never wrote a tshuva that it's mutter. So obviously he thinks that it's also. How is it obvious that he thinks that it's also? He never wrote a tshuva. So they say from Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach printed. He says, the Gemara here means the same as the Gemara there by Horikina B'Shabbos, that since it's microscopic, the eggs are probably microscopic when they're in the flesh of the fish, when they turn into worms. So to the naked eye, it appeared as if the flesh of the fish turned into worms, because we didn't see those eggs in the fish. So Reb Shlomo Zalman said, that's the pshat in the Gemara. So now they're tumbling that some of these worms were visible to the naked eye when the fish swallowed them and they went into the stomach. They are visible to the naked eye in the stomach. Barely visible. You have to have sharp eyes. You have very good eyes, so they are visible. So then they said, Reb Shlomo Zalman's interpretation of the Gemara no longer applies. So now you should ask the worms, because they are visible. So in the days of the Gemara, we knew that they were not visible when they were in the stomach. So one of the Rabbanim, Rabbi Belsky from Tarvadas, suggested, I think you have to accept what he said. I think it's Pasha Pshat in the Gemara. You have to say it like that. He said, if you look in the Beis Yosef, in the Shulchan Aruch, on this simon about the worms, so the Beis Yosef and the Prima Godim quotes this Beis Yosef. So he says, the worms that you find in the stomach of the fish, obviously the fish swallowed the worms from outside. So the Beis Yosef writes that the worms in the stomach are osa misafik. Why is it osa misafik? It vada that it came from the outside. So the suffix is that the Gemara seems to assume, of course all the worms come from the outside, but any worm that will succeed in penetrating the membrane of the stomach and going into the and succeed in getting into the flesh of the fish, so that worm is considered as if when the fish swallows it and it lands inside the stomach, it's already considered part of the fish. It blends in to be considered part of the fish. So any worm in the stomach is asa misafik, because you don't know, maybe this worm would succeed in penetrating through the membrane and going into the flesh. Anyone which will ultimately penetrate into the flesh of the fish will be mutter. See, it's mutter even before it penetrates into the fish. So that's why Yosef Kara writes that all the worms in the stomach are also misafik. But by us, we throw out the stomach. So we're talking about worms that you find in the flesh of the fish. So whatever you find in the flesh of the fish is mutter. It's considered as if it blends into the flesh of the fish. Either like Reb Shlaim Zalman interpreted in the Gemara. You don't have to interpret the Gemara that it means that it's spontaneously generated, that the flesh of the fish turns into worms. Either Reb Shlaim Zalman wrote years ago that it means that the worms were microscopic when they were in the flesh of the fish, and then when they develop into, when the egg develops into a visible worm, it looks as if the flesh of the fish converted into worms. That's what the Gemara means is mutter. Or even if the worms were visible, they're barely visible, even if they were considered visible when they were in the stomach of the fish, any worm that will succeed in penetrating through the membrane of the stomach and going into the flesh, so that's considered even before it goes into the flesh, that's considered part of the flesh of the fish, and it's mutter. There was a great Goyen who died years ago. He was a great-grandson of the Chasam Sofer. He writes he was the first great-grandson to be named Moshe after the Chasam Sofer. And he calls his Sefer Dor Revi. He's the fourth generation after the Chasam Sofer, the first one to be named. He was the Rav in Kloisenberg, I think. His name is Moshe Glasner. Glasner. So he has a beautiful Sefer on Chulin, very modern thinker, open mind, like along the style of Brisk. He was a Rav in Kloisenberg, but it's like a Brisker style. He raises issues, very open-minded, very interesting sefer. So he has an introduction to the Dor Revi on Chulin. The Satmar Rebbe didn't hold from him because he was a Zionist. He gave up his Rabbanus and he moved to Eretz Yisrael way before Hakamas HaMedina, way before. So the Satmar Rebbe held he was an Apikoros and he didn't recommend you should use his book. Okay, maybe, I don't know, I have no idea. But the sefer is a very good sefer on Chulin. When you're learning Chulin, kedai to use the Dor Revi. So he has an introduction that has controversial things. The introduction is really an introduction to Torah Shebal Peh. It's not really an introduction to Chulin. It's an introduction to all of Torah Shebal Peh. So one, he has some controversial things there. So one piece that he has is the following. The Ramban, in his commentary on the Sefer HaMitzvahs, LaHaRambam, raises Akasha. That Rashi in his commentary on Chumash writes on the Pasuk in Parsha Shoftim, it says when the Rabbonim have a machlokes and they can't resolve the issue, you have Dibrei Riva, Kipolimim Chodova La Mishpat, you have a machlokes, Dibrei Riva is Bisharech, a machlokes, and you can't resolve it, so they come to Be'alisa Lamokim, you should go to the Bez Nahagorel in Yerushalayim, whatever they pasken is binding. And it says, L'sasme Koladovash Yagidul Chayom Nesmo, you're not allowed to ignore what the Bez Nagorl says. You have to follow the Pesach. So Rashi in his commentary on Chumash quotes from the Sifrei on that Pesach. Why does it say Yomin is small? Afil Omim Lucha Yemin Shu Small V'Asmol Sheimin. So the simple translation of the Rashi sounds like he's saying, even if the Bez Nagorl made a mistake and they tell you to go to the right, and they're really giving you in the wrong direction, so they tell you to go to the left and you should really go to the right, whatever the Rabbonim tell you, you're obligated to follow, even if you know that it's wrong. That's what the simple translation of the words sounds like it says. So the Ramban is the first one who raised this problem. When you study Maseches Horius, the first Mishnah says not so. The very opening Mishnah. The first Perik and Horius talks about the institution of Par Halam Davashel Tzibur. Par Halam Davashel Tzibur is a din in the Torah that if a private individual was Mechal Shabbos B'Shoigeg, or he ate Chayla B'dam, or he ate Chametz B'Pesach, he ate on Yom Kippur, B'Shoigeg, if one violated an aver b'sheigig, which if he would have violated it b'mezid, he would have been punished with kares. So if you violate the aver b'sheigig, you have to bring a korban chatas. What if the reason why he violated the avera was because the Bezna HaGadol paskin that this activity is mutter? And then, everybody, if the Bezna HaGadol says it's mutter, if the Bez Nagadol says something is mutas, everyone's going to follow. Why should somebody decide to be machmir? So the Torah says, if Roiv HaTzibur in Eretz Yisrael, 51% of the Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael violated this Avera, because they were following innocently, they were following the Psak of the Bez Nagadol, Then the Beis Nagel backs out, and they advertise in the newspapers, we made a mistake, and nobody should turn on lights on Shabbos. We thought it's mutter, and it's really a melacha. So the Torah says, you don't require each and every individual person who violated Chil Shabbos, you should go bring a Korban Chatas. The Beis Nagel brings one Korban Chatas on behalf of the whole Tzibur, and that's called Par Halam Dovah Shel Tzibur. In other religions, they have an Iker and Amun of the papal infallibility. So we don't have such a, a human being who's infallible. Moshe Rabbeinu can make a mistake. The only one who does make mistakes is the Rabban Shalom. The whole Beis Nagadol, 71, the biggest Rabbanim. And clearly, so it's possible that they could all make a mistake, and the Torah prescribes a din of a Parhalam Dovah Shel Tzibur, if the Rav HaTzibur violated the Averim. So they have to bring a Parhalam Dovah Shel Tzibur. So the Mishnah says explicitly, the opening Mishnah, Maseches Ha'iriyah, says that if the whole Beis Nagadol unanimously paskins that something is mutter, and there's one person who knows that the psak is incorrect. I marked their exams when they were learning for smicha, and they got smicha with a 65. And this issue that they're passing wrong is one of the 35% of the questions that they didn't know the answer to. I know that they're wrong. So it says in the Mishnah, you're not allowed to follow the psak of the Beis Nagadol. If you know that they made a mistake, you're not allowed to follow. So how can the Rashi and Chumash quote from the Sifrei, Ayimin shu smol, vas smol shu yimin, doesn't it contradict the Mishnah, the first Mishnah, Maseches Ha'iriyah? So the Ramban is the first one who raises the question, and after the Ramban, many discuss it. The Ramban explains that the correct girsa, the correct reading in the Sifrei, should not say that you know that they made a mistake. It means a lot of times you go to a doctor, so the doctor prescribes a medication, so the layman thinks that the doctor does know what he's talking about. What do you mean? That medication is for different sickness and not for this sickness. Well, a lot of times, let's say a chemist will predict something, or a physicist will predict something, and a layman who's not in the field, he's not familiar with this specific discipline, will think that that's ridiculous. So the same is true in learning, in any discipline. Someone who is a mumche in the field will say something that's startling, and for one who is not in the field, he'll think that that's ridiculous. So the Ramban thinks that that's what the girsa should be. If it's really al yimin shu smol, if the Beis Nagadol made a mistake, you're not allowed to follow them. But if you as a layman think that it doesn't make any sense, so then you should follow their psak and assume that you didn't understand it, and then they do know what they're talking about. But if you know for sure they made a mistake, so that's a further question. When is it considered that you know for sure, and when is it considered that I think they don't know what they're talking about? That's another question. So that's what the Ramban suggests. So this, I'll just give other suggestions. So this Sefer Dor Revi, in his introduction, he's working on this kasha. The Sifrei quoted by Rashi and Chumash says, "Afilu amin shu smol al smol shu yimin," and the opening Mishnah Hariyah says, "Not so." So he thinks the teretz is the following. He thinks if the Chachamim give a psak based on, let's say, mistaken scientific information, and in the generation when they gave the psak, it was already known to the whole world. The scientists of their generation knew that this was incorrect. So that psak is wrong, and you're not allowed to follow such a psak. But if in the generation when they gave the psak, that was considered on the cutting edge of science, that was accepted as scientifically correct. So even if in later generations it's discovered that that was incorrect, so that's when Mr. Yahimin Shu is small. I personally think it does not make any sense. If it's a mistake, it's still a mistake. But he thinks that this is the teretz. And he writes, that's why it's still permissible to kill the lice on Shabbos, and that's why it's permissible to eat the worms and the fish, because the Tanaim thought that these lice and the worms and the fish were spontaneously generated. So even though years later we came to the realization that it was all incorrect, but since in the days of the Tanaim that was scientifically accepted as being correct, so that halacha remains. Chazanish has something similar, but not the same. Similar. Well, we may get to the Chazanish a little later. Yeah. So this is his position. But I think it's Rav Shlomo Zalman did not think like that. Rav Shlomo Zalman, the others, they thought if it's discovered to be incorrect, he should throw out the din also. The answer is, we say that that's what it meant, since it's not visible to the naked eye. So that's why it's considered as if it's spontaneously generated. That's the Pashtus. Herman Wook taught in the yeshiva 2 years. So he told the students 1 year that the theme of his book, the Cain Mutiny, there was a mutiny on the boat, on the ship. So the theme of the book was that Rashi, that authority is binding even when it's an error. So one of the students told me that's not pshat in Rashi. So he's very disappointed. Authority is not binding when it's an error. If they made a mistake, he made a mistake. In the days of the Gemara, when they would perform a bris, that they would bathe the baby with warm water before and after the bris, in order to prevent infection. And the Gemara says that if you perform the bris, sometimes you perform a bris on Shabbos. The baby was born on Shabbos, so the meal of his man is derech Shabbos. So if you perform the bris on Shabbos and you realize you don't have warm water, so you have to get a nochri to heat up some water. And if you can't get a Shabbos guy, you have to heat up the water yourself, violate the malacha of mevashel. There's a malacha mevashel to cook water even if you're not going to drink the water, even if you're going to take a hot shower, hot bath. And even if you're not making it 212, if you make it yatzoletis is way below 212, that's also mevashel. So the Gemara says it's permissible and obligatory to heat up the water in order to bathe the baby after the bris, because it's a suffix sakana. So Rabbi Yosef Karo, who lived in the 1500s in Eretz Yisrael, I don't know, the hygienic conditions were so much better than in the days of the Gemara, I'm not familiar. So he writes that it's just not so. It's just not so. There's no suffix sakana to the baby. Especially today, there's for sure there's not. Today they use antiseptics. So for sure there's no suffix sakana today. But Rabbi Yosef Karo didn't have any antiseptics. And he still says, we know that there's no suffix sakana. So you're not allowed to heat up any water on Shabbos. Even though the Gemara says that it's a suffix sakana, it's not a suffix sakana. So that's why it's problematic. The Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah gives you a whole list of different machlas. And the Gemara says you're only permitted to be Mechal Shabbos, permitted and obligated to be Mechal Shabbos if a person's life is in danger, if there's mamish sakonis, even a sex fake of a suffix sakonis. So the Gemara gives a list of certain conditions that are considered suffix sakonis. So we know today that these are not a suffix sakana. So the pashtus is that once you realize today, the doctors of your generation say it's not a suffix sakana, so you shouldn't be allowed to be mechal shabbos. Just like it says in Shulchan Aruch, you're not allowed to heat up the water for the bris, because today we know that it's not a suffix sakana. So many of the modern svarim write, no, whatever it says in the Gemara is a suffix sakana, you have to be mechal shabbos. And whatever the doctors of our generation say is a suffix sakana, even though the Gemara says not a suffix sakana, so you have to be mechal shabbos for that too. The Pashto says that we should follow in the footsteps of the Tanoim. The Tanoim followed the doctors of their generation, so we should follow the doctors of our generation. And their generation, the doctors said, when you do such a surgery, you have to use hot water. And the doctors had a whole list of what they considered suffix sakana. It was not a suffix sakana. So it should depend on each generation, whatever they think is a suffix sakana. That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch, that we no longer heat up the water after the bris. Not let it be Mechal Shabbos, because we know today it's not a suffix sakana. That's part of the issue regarding mitzitza. The Gemara Masechet Shabbos in Perek Rav Elazar d'Milo says after you finish performing the bris, so you have to perform mitzitza, you have to draw a little bit of blood out. So the Gemara says, and if the moel doesn't perform mitzitza, you fire the moel. The Gemara says, why do you fire the moel? Let's say if a secretary doesn't do the work properly, so you fire the secretary right away. No, you tell her, painter is not doing the job correctly. So you tell him, I want the letters like this, I want it typed like this, I want it like that. You have to warn her a few times. If each time you keep on telling the secretary, I want you to write the letters like this, and she doesn't listen, he doesn't listen, they keep on doing that. So then you fire, but you don't fire right away. And Mara says, no, if the mother doesn't do the mitzitza, you fire him right away, because it's a suffix sakana to the baby. So the Gemara never really said that mitzitza is only for sakana purposes. The Gemara says the reason why we fire the moel, we don't warn him a few times before we fire him, is because it's a suffix sakana. So that's what some say, that even if you ascertain that by using antiseptics there's no suffix sakana at all, but the Gemara never said that the only reason why you have mitzitza is suffix sakana. Maybe mitzitza is part of the mitzvah bris milah. Maybe they had a tradition that's part of the mitzvah. That's what some say. And others understood the Gemara. No, the Gemara sounds perhaps, doesn't really say, the Gemara perhaps sounds like it says that the only reason why you do mitzitza is because there's a suffix sakana. And then, so some say that Bizman is there, that you use antiseptics, that there's no suffix sakana. The doctors, the non-Jews do circumcision, they don't do mitzitza. For many generations, they don't do mitzitza, and the babies never die because of the lack of mitzitza. Sometimes the babies die for other reasons, not because of a lack of mitzitza. So what are we still being Mechal Shabbos to do Metzitza for, if Metzitza is a Malachim? So the Maharam Shik has a tshuva that all of medical knowledge is based on all the cases that they did. They have hundreds of thousands of cases that they've performed circumcision on babies, and in all of their cases, that no one ever died because of a lack of Metzitza. So the Maharam Shik writes, well, they had 500,000 cases, they had a million cases. Maybe if they'll have a million of one cases, maybe one of them will die because of a lack of Metzitza. And that's also called the Safik Sakana. If it's one chance out of a million and one that someone's going to die, that's called the Safik Sakana. That's what he argues. The Pashtus is not like the Maharam Shik, that if there's one chance in a million that someone's going to die, that's called the Safik Sakana. People would laugh at that. The Chasam Sofer writes, Chasam Sofer was the Rebbe of the Maharam Shik. He writes in a famous tshuva that's printed on the bottom of the page in Yeridei and Hilchas Bikur Cholim, and have the dinim for the doctors in the end of Yeridei. So Chasam Sofer says, whenever there's a Safik Echad Min Yalef Alfi Alafim, one chance in a million, that's not called the Safik Sakana. It has to be a Safik that people are concerned about, that people are nervous about. If it's so far-fetched, the Safik Sakana, that people are simply not nervous about it, then the Gemara invokes the Pasuk Shamei Psoim Hashem, that the Rabbanu Shlomo will watch over us. We don't have to be concerned about putting our lives into a Safik Sakana. That's not considered putting your life into a Safik Sakana. So that's part of the debate today. Should we still do Metzitza? There are two parts to the debate. One part is maybe you don't have to do Metzitza at all. Then there's another issue, even if you do have to do Metzitza, who says it has to be Metzitza Bepeh? But you look in this Dechemet, he has a long kuntres, 40 pages long. Dechemet lived in the early 1900s, and first he lived in Russia. He was born in Hebron, and then he got a Rabbanus in Russia, and he didn't know whether he was coming or going. He never heard of the Minhagim there. So he corresponded with all the Rabbanim in Russia to ascertain, all the Rabbanim in Litva and Poland, all over, to ascertain whether the Balabatim made up these Minhagim or they really existed. He was a Sephardi. He didn't know whether the Balabatim were making stories up or they really... So that's why he wrote a whole sefer, a collection of all the letters from the Rabbanim on the Minhagim and everything, and then it developed to become a whole encyclopedia. Then he moved back to Eretz Yisrael, B'Seif Yomav. He moved back to Eretz Yisrael. He has a long kuntres, a Metzitza, 40-page kuntres. So the first 20 pages, he wants to claim that you have to do Metzitza. In the second half of the last 20 pages, he quotes everybody who says it has to be Metzitza B'Peh. Not only have to do Metzitza, it has to be Metzitza B'Peh. So this is part of the question, that today you have antiseptics, so what do you have to do Metzitza for? You know that there isn't going to be any infection. So one of the Achranim writes, who says the Gemara meant it's a sakana, a physical sakana to the baby? Maybe it's a sakana, the baby will become an apikiris. A new pshat. One of the Achranim makes such a suggestion. Maybe it's a sakana for apikursis. Maybe that's what the Gemara meant. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a sakana. The antiseptic will help for the health of the child. The antiseptic is not going to help to prevent it from becoming an apikiris. So that's an issue. The Pashtus is that any medical issue that says in the Gemara, the Chasam Sofer, and that Shuvah that I'm mentioning, where he says, Echem hi'ini yalef alfi alofim, there's one chance in a million that there's a Safik Sakana, and people are not nervous about it, so that's not called Safik Sakana. So in that Shuvah he discusses, where did the Tanaim get all of their medical information from? So he said, they didn't have Halacha L'Moshe Mitzrayim. They relied on the doctors of their generation. So we should do the same as the Tanaim. We should rely on the doctors of our generation, just like they relied on the doctors of their generation. We should rely on the doctors of our generation. The Chasam Sofer writes in another tshuva that's quoted on the bottom of the page in Shulchan Aruch in another place, that the Rambam left out a lot of Gemaras, where the Gemara makes medical statements, because the Rambam knew medicine, and he knew that the medicine of his day didn't agree with the medicine of the days of the Gemara. So he writes, the Gemara says in Psochim and Daf Ayin Vav, that it's not healthy if you cook meat and fish together, there's some kind of a sakana or another. And the Rambam never quoted that Gemara. So the Chasam Sofer says, the Rambam knew medicine of his day. And just like in the days of the Tanaim, they relied on the doctors of their generation. So the Rambam relied on the doctors of his generation. Doctors of his generation said, there's no sakana. So he left out that Gemara. He says, the Rambam left out a lot of Gemaras that make statements about medical issues, because he followed the medicine of his generation. That's the Pashtus, what it says in Shulchan Aruch about heating up the water on Shabbos after the bris. That this man is, it's not a Safik Sakana, so we follow the doctors of our generation. There's a famous Gemara in the end of the first Perek in Ma'in Katan, where the Gemara says, that the best time to eat fish, if you catch a fish, the best time is soon before it's about to get spoiled. If you leave the fish out of the refrigerator for a week, it's going to get spoiled. So the best time is leave it out for 6 days and then eat the fish, right before it's about to get spoiled. So Tosis writes on the side of the Gemara that we don't follow that. We follow doctors of our generation. The longer it's out of the refrigerator, so the more it's decomposing. It's no good. You should eat it when it's fresh. You don't eat it later. So Tosis says we're not allowed to follow what the Gemara's recommendations about health and science. We're not allowed to follow. We have either the rules of science changed, either the health changed, Tana Hateva, or the Gemara made a mistake, whichever it is. There's such a passage in Gittin, the beginning of Perek Mishal Sukur Daikis. So the Gemara gives different refuas, how to cure different sicknesses. So the Rashba, not Gemara, quotes from the Gaonim that whoever follows the medical advice of the Gemara, Dama Beroshim. If he dies, it's his own fault. You shouldn't follow the advice of the Gemara. You should follow in the footsteps of the Gemara. The Chachmei HaGemara relied on the doctors of their generation, so we should rely on the doctors of our generation. The medicine in the Gemara is not necessarily going to work bizman hazeh. You have to follow the doctors of your own generation. In the days of the Gemara, there was a machlokes hatanoim. There's a din of a woman gives birth to a baby, there's a full-term pregnancy, and there's a premature baby. So a premature baby is a suffix nafel. So you have to wait a while to see whether the child is considered a bar kayama or is a nafel. So let's say, for chalitza purposes, let's say a man is married and he dies, he leaves no children, no grandchildren, no descendants, and he has a brother, a surviving brother, so the almana has to have chalitza from the brother. What happens if the almana has a baby? When the husband passed away, the almana had a little baby, and the baby died soon after the husband died. Or the woman was pregnant, the almana was pregnant, and then she gave birth to a baby after the husband died, and then the baby died soon after. So the Gemara says, if the pregnancy was a full-term pregnancy, and then the baby died, so then she doesn't have to have chalitza. That's like, let's say the woman had a child, and the child is 50 years old. The husband died at the age of 85, and they had a child, and the child is 50 years old. And then the child dies, after the husband died, the child dies. So she doesn't need chalitza. The husband left the child. Even though the child died after the husband, so you don't need chalitza in such a case. So here, the Gemara says, what if the woman had a baby and it died soon after it was born? Do you consider the vlada suffik nefil, or do you consider the vlada bar kayama? So the Gemara says, if it's a full-term pregnancy, so it's a bar kayama. Even if it dies the next day, even if it dies the same day, tinik ben yamechud, it's poiter esima min achalitza. But if it wasn't a full-term pregnancy, it was a premature baby, and then it dies within 30 days, so then it's a suffik nefil. So then the woman would need chalitza mi suffik. So the Gemara has a discussion, what's considered a full-term pregnancy? So the Gemara has a machlokes, whether you're ledus letisha, if a woman has a nine-month pregnancy, that's what we usually assume, nine-month pregnancy, is it normal that she has the baby into the beginning of the ninth month? That's called yoledus limikutoin, into the ninth month, or no? Yoledus letisha, any yoledus limikutoin. Full-term pregnancy means 9 months, each one having 30 days. So Acharonim wrote, each month has 29, 30, Jewish calendar, and the later Acharonim say that's against the Gemara. The Gemara says 9 times 30, not 9 months on the Jewish calendar. 9 times 30 days, 270 days. So this is a machlekes in the Gemara, and it's a machlekes in the Rishonim, where the Yoledes Letisha, is it considered full term if she gave birth in the beginning of the ninth month? Is it only considered full term pregnancy if she gave birth after 9 full months of 30 days each? So the Ramah, in the end of Ibn Ezra, in Hilchas Chalitza, writes, whatever it was in the days of the Gemara, whatever it was in the days of the Rishonim, had a dispute about it, is irrelevant today. The Ramah lives in the 1500s, and he quotes from the Tashbeits, who lived at least 100 years before, I think. Tashbeits lived in Algeria, he was earlier, the time of the Iran. So the Tshuvas HaTashbeit says that Bizman Hazeh, it's perfectly normal that a woman is your lettuce, and gives birth in the beginning of the ninth month. That's not called the Sofik Nefil, that's called the Vadai Bar Kayom. So the Ramah says, also, we follow the doctors of our generation. In the days of the Gemara, they had a question. Apparently the doctors had a dispute. In the days of the Tashbeit, and Mizman Hazeh, we assume that that's perfectly normal. The Gemara does talk, let's say a woman has a premature baby, the baby is born before she enters into the ninth month. The baby is born in the eighth month. So then the Gemara says that the child is considered a suffix nafil till he reaches the age of 20. 20. He can't be mitzarfim to a minyan. He can't give him an aliyah. Bar mitzvah. Can't give him an aliyah because he's walking around. He goes to school. He got married. It's a suffix. Maybe he's dead. Maybe he's a dead man walking around. So the Chazon Ish writes, that was only Bizman HaGemara. But Bizman is there that we have an they put the baby in an incubator. It's like holding the baby in the mother's womb another month. So if they hold the baby in an incubator for another month and the doctors release the baby, so that's considered as if it was Kolol HaChadoshim. That's considered as if it's a full-term pregnancy and you don't have to wait till the age of 20. That's what the Chazon Ish writes. So there was the Goyen HaBezna of Yerushalayim, Rav Weiss, who wrote the Minchas Yitzchak. He was a Rav Manchester, and then he came to be the head of the Eidah Haredus. So he comments on the Chazon Ish. Who gave the Chazon Ish the right to disagree with the Gemara? We don't follow the Chazon Ish. We follow the Gemara. You have to wait, even if the baby was put in an incubator and the doctors released them and they said it's a perfectly normal baby, healthy baby, you have to still wait till the age of 20 to make sure that he's not a Suffolk knave. So remember, I said this over in Yeshiva once. I said over the Chazon Ish, and then I said jokingly that the Minchas Yitzchak says, who gave the Chazon Ish the permission to disagree with the Gemara? And it's a suffix navel. So 2.5 years go by, and one of the boys comes up to me, he was in my shiur for 3 years, comes up and he says, Mazel Tov, he knows he's alive today. I don't know what in the world he's talking about. He says he was just 20. He was then 18, now he's 20. So I said, what do you mean? He says he started to sweat. When I said the Minchas Yitzchak, I said it jokingly. Minchas Yitzchak disagrees. He said, who gave the Chazon Ish the right to disagree? So the boy says he started to perspire and he got so scared and he was petrified for the last 2 years, 2.5 years. And now he knows he's alive. So Bazel Tov, he's alive. The Pashtus is like the Chazon Ish. The Tanoim got it from the doctors of their generation. So if the doctors of our generation say that they put in an incubator, so Shaila. Regarding what we mentioned before about the fish and the flesh, so the Chasam Sofer says the Rambam left it out because the Rambam follows the doctors of his generation. So in the Shulchan Aruch they quote this, you shouldn't eat fish that was cooked with flesh. On the side of the Shulchan Aruch they say the sakana only is if the fish was cooked in the same oven with the flesh. If you use the same fork, that doesn't say in the Shulchan Aruch. That's the B'nai Yisrael Hechmiru Alatzman. The women are so careful about health foods that they never give cholent, and their husbands are never overweight, and we don't have any cholesterol, and nobody smokes, and everybody's so careful about the health, so the women don't even want to have, there should be the amashahu, a fish, on the fork, so they have two different forks. This is a little bit of such an exaggeration. You have people, they'll do kol davarasa, they'll eat all the unhealthy foods, but fish cooked in flesh, that they won't eat. That's like we once discussed, the Shalom is of the opinion that you're not allowed to eat turkey. Because the Ashkenazim have a minig based on Rashi's comment on the Gemara Chulin that you have to have a masor, you have to have a tradition on a bird that it's kosher. Even though you can identify the bird as being kosher based on the simonim, the Gemara tells you what the simonim are to identify. So Rashi comments on the Gemara that on one occasion the Amoraim misidentified a bird as being kosher. Then after a couple of months of eating the bird, they stopped because they realized they made a mistake. So if the Amoroi made a mistake, we can also make a mistake. So Rashi recommends, in the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam quotes it, the Ashkenazim, we follow the Rashi, you shouldn't eat any exotic birds unless you have a tradition on it. So when Columbus discovered America and brought the turkey back to Europe, so the Sfardim started eating turkey because the Sfardim don't have this chumrah. They checked the turkey, it has all the simonim of kashrut, so it's a kosher bird. The Ashkenazim didn't realize that. So after 50 years, the Ashkenazim saw the Sfardim were eating the turkey, so they said they must have had a tradition that it's a kosher, so they started eating the turkey. But the truth of the matter is, they never had a tradition. So people who eat turkey are really probably in violation of this minhag, that you shouldn't eat the bird without a tradition. So the Shalom, on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, they quote, the Shalom's descendants don't eat turkey. One of the rabbis in the yeshiva is named Horowitz. He's a descendant of the Shalom. So he says he has cousin Horowitz. They'll eat chazer on Yom Kippur, but turkey they'll never eat. That's out of the question. So that's over here also. The people are so careful about not eating the flesh with the fish, the cholent dalit, and overeat, and double portions, and potato chips, and peanuts, and popcorn, and crackers, everything else they do eat. Only the fish with the flesh. So the Magen Avraham writes in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, Magen Avraham lived in the 1600s. He says, today the doctors think there's no sakana. So he doesn't think that concern applies anymore. The Chasam Sofer said that's the reason why the Rambam left it out. Because the Rambam followed the doctors of his generation. There's no sakana. The Magen Avraham lived centuries after the Rambam. So he says, even though the Shulchan Aruch quotes it, he says that today he doesn't think there's any Sufik sakana. So the Nadi Yehuda says, well, we're still not sure. We're still not sure. Maybe there is still a Sufik sakana with the fish and the flesh. The Gemara talks about a woman who was married and her husband died. So is there a Sufik sakana that maybe who was ever going to marry her is going to die? Everybody has to die sometime or another. So the Gemara says, if two husbands in a row died, machlek is with two or three in a row, then we label the woman as a katlanis, and it's a Sufik sakana that no one should marry her because a chashash, maybe the third husband will also die. So the Rambam has a said in the Shulchan Aruch, they quote all the klolim from the Gemara about the katlanis. So the Rambam has a famous tshuva where he writes, we always read shiduchim for katlanis. And he says, we have a tradition for the Ri Megash. We don't worry about katlanis. The Gemara is talking about those people who are nervous about it. So the Gemara says, if you want to be nervous, so you only have to be nervous under these conditions. But if you're not nervous, so don't be nervous.
What about the other way around? If the man married two wives and they die, is he katlan also?
No. The Gemara does not think it's a katlan. They thought, the doctors of their generation thought that there's some kind of a medical reason why in this direction. And the doctors in the later generation. Right, the Gemara has two suggestions. So one is maybe Mirashamayim, they wanted to be an almona. And then the other explanation is that it's a medical concern, that Mokar Germ, the Gemara Sofik, whether Mokar Germ or Mazal Germ. Yeah, so the both explanations the Gemara gives only apply with respect to the husband's dying, not with respect, unless you have a good explanation why, unless you know. I have a cousin, a female cousin, so the first time she got married, she knew in advance that her husband had a weak heart. And they had a few children, and then the husband died. He died from a condition that he had before he got married. Then the second husband that she married was 20 years older than her. He was never married before. So she married her teacher. When she was in high school, she had a teacher who was never married. So he married a teacher. So he died at a ripe old age. He died way before she did. So she was not considered a katlanis. And now she's married and has more children from the third husband. So they give in Shulchan Aruch where you for sure don't have to worry about Katlan. But in the commentaries on the side of Shulchan Aruch, they quote the Rambam, quotes for the Ri Megash, that we're not really concerned about this Katlan. It wasn't really a real medical concern that the Tanoim had. They said from one who's spooky and one who's nervous about it, so let him not marry the Katlan. But you're not supposed to be nervous about it. In recent years in Eretz Yisrael, after Hakamas HaMedina, and they had the whole system of the Rabbanut, so there was a woman who got divorced from her husband and she wanted child support. So the husband claimed the child is not his. So he says he's going to prove it. You can tell by taking a test of the type of the blood. If the father has this kind of type, A+, and the mother has B-, whatever, I don't know, whatever they are. So the child can only have such a blood type. So one of the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael said, apikursus, that there's no such thing as determining who the father is based on the blood type, even though in the world of science, in the world of medicine, this is accepted. So you say, because there's a passage in the Gemara, there's an agada in the Gemara, that shlosh shutvim yesh ba'adam, that the father and the mother and the Baruch Shalom are the three partners in creating a little baby, and the mother gives the child the blood, and the father gives the child the white part of the body, and the Baruch Shalom gives the soul. So how can you tell me that by testing the father's blood type you can identify whether this child is from the father or not if the Holy Gemara says that the blood is given from the mother, not from the father? So the Rav Herzog was the chief rabbi at that time. So he was so furious about this. So he wrote a letter that they just printed about 15 years ago. a very nasty letter to this Rav. He said, are you off your mind? How do you give such a stupid psak? He says, the scientists didn't come up with this yesterday. This is mekubal. This is accepted in the world of medicine for many years already. They have no kashas on this. They're not going to back down from this. This has been tested many times over. And he complains, he like the ostrich. The whole world is marching on, and the rabbis are like the ostrich who sticks his head in the sand, and he doesn't want to march on with the rest of the world. You have to wake up and live, and you have to follow the doctors of your generation. So that letter, it was a nasty letter that Rav Herzog wrote to this Rav. So it was printed just about 10 years ago. I think that Rav had, they waited till that Rav passed away. And then they printed the letter, they didn't say who it was to, but apparently a lot of people knew. There is just a month ago, we had a guest in the yeshiva, some professor, I think his name is Jacobson from MIT, who originally went to law school, I think. And he says when he went to law school, he came to the realization that you can draw up a contract that will not be covered by any law. You can word a contract in such a way that the law will not say anything about your contract. And now that he's observant, now he learns Daf Yomi, he became Shomer Mitzvahs, and he learns Daf Yomi, and he enjoys it very much. So now he sees that the Torah has something to say on every case. There's no such case that the halacha doesn't have what to say. So he is a big fan of the Daf Yomi. So first he went to law school, and then he was stark into physics. So he invented the Kindle that people use to read books. And probably invented another 1,001 things also. And now he's already Yoytzi given the physics. Now he's into biology. And he's doing genetic engineering. He's using genes from vegetables and animals, genes from animals and vegetables. So he came to the yeshiva, and he was speaking. He had every 45 minutes he met with someone else. He was talking with different people the whole day long. He came to kidnap two students from the yeshiva college to take them back to MIT to help him do his work. And his genetic engineering. So he got a couple of geniuses there. He gave a lecture in the nighttime, and two geniuses were following him. So they knew what he was talking about, so he wants to kidnap them and bring them back to MIT to help him in his research. So he tells me that in yesterday's Daf Yomi, they learned the Mishnah in Chulin about the Achbor. The Mishnah talks about a mouse that's half flesh and half sand. And the problem is, does such a thing exist? It doesn't exist. So the Rambam writes in the Pirush HaMishnayos, oh, we've heard many people said they know, they saw such a mouse. It does exist. But later generations say it doesn't exist. So he says, this Mishnah doesn't bother him. He says, he understands that the style of the Talmud is to talk about all the wild cases, even if they don't yet exist. He says, I may make it. He's a humble person. He's not arrogant. He says, I may make such a mouse. With his genetic engineering. So he understands in law school, he realized that the secular law does not cover every case. But halacha has to cover every case, so the rabbis have to talk about all the wild cases, even if it doesn't exist yet, because it may come into existence. So I mentioned to him, so he wrote it down, he liked it. I mentioned there's a Tosfos in the beginning of Ksubis. The Gemara says that one starts observing Shiva after Stimas HaGoylo. What does the word mean, Stimas HaGoylo? So Rashi translates, when you put the lid on the coffin, so then the Avelus begins. Tosfos disagrees. We have to bury him. The Avelus doesn't begin before the Gevurah. So Tosfos, Rabbi Natam disagrees with Rashi. We follow the Rabbi Natam. That Stimas HaGoylo means when you put the Matzeva. Why is it called the Goylo? So they used to roll it. They used to have a Matzeva that could roll. We don't have round Matzevas. We have rectangular shaped Matzevas. So Tosfos asks on Rashi, there is a Gemara in Erevin on Daf Tezvav in the first parak in Erevin where the Gemara talks about what's the din if you use the live animal as a goylo. Does it have the din of tumas a goylo? The goylo is matame ba'oyo, magam masa ba'oyo, like a mace. So the Gemara has a discussion, what if you have a live animal and you use it as a goylo, will it be matame? So Taisa says, what are you talking about? According to Rashi, the lid of a coffin, which Meshugan is going to use a live animal for as the lid of a coffin? So that's ridiculous. Obviously, the Rabbi Natam is right, that it's talking about the girl means a matzeva. Which Meshugan is going to use a live animal as a matzeva? So Tosfos says, no, sometimes you finish the kvura, and you don't have a matzeva. So we don't put up a matzeva till 30 days later, till a year later, different minhagim. We don't put up a matzeva right away. So Tosfos says, the Avelus begins when you completed the kvura. So if you plan to put up a matzeva right away, so you didn't finish the gvur till you put up the matzeva. If you're not going to put up a matzeva, so you finished. So Tosfos says, Bizmana Gemara, the practice was they would always put a matzeva right away. So sometimes they didn't have a matzeva prepared yet. They're going to have it tomorrow, the day after. So they would knock a peg of wood. They would put a peg of wood in the ground over there. Then they would tie an animal to the peg of wood. That's the temporary matzeva. So that's what the Gemara means. If you use the live animal as a goylal, does it have a din of tumah or not? But according to Rashi, which Meshugan is going to use a live animal as the lid on the coffin? You're going to bury the live animal alive? That's ridiculous. Then Tosfos says, but it's not a kasha against Rashi, because the Talmud Bavli always discusses abstract dinim, what the din is in a case, even if it's never going to come up in a million years. No normal person, which Meshugan is going to use a live animal as a lid on the coffin. But the Gemara, the Stalin Gemara, they always discuss halachas, even if it's never going to come up in a million years. And they quote, as the Gemara discusses in the end of Pchoris, the Gemara has a case that's never going to come up in a million years. The Gemara has a case, one cow already gave birth, and now it's pregnant with the second birth. And you take the embryo from this, the womb of this cow, and you implant it in the womb of another cow who never gave birth yet. But this is not the embryo from that, this is from the other cow. The Gemara has a discussion whether it has a din of b'chor behemot Torah. So Tosfos says it's never going to come up in a million years. Now they do it every day. They do it by human beings every day. They do it by animals every day. They do it all the time. So Tosfos says that's the style of the Talmud Bavli to discuss all the cases, because the Gemara has to cover all the cases. That's what this professor realized, the difference between Jewish law and secular law, that the halacha has what to say about everything. There is no case that's not covered by the halacha. So he was very excited to hear that Tosfos in the beginning of Ksuvos. Then I told Moshe the Chazon Ish, we have a klal dina de malchus adina, that the secular law is binding if one of the people involved in the case is a non-Jew. If all the people involved in the case are Jewish, and the secular law is not binding. Because we have the Shulchan Aruch, we follow the Shulchan Aruch. So there are certain cases where it is binding. Let's say rent control, minimum wages. So Rav Henkin wrote a tshuva many years ago. They used to have landlords were Jewish and they would only rent to Jewish tenants, because he said whenever everybody involved is Jewish, so the secular law doesn't apply. So I'm not bound by the laws of rent control. But they would have Jewish bosses, had a factory, and they had Jewish employees, so they wouldn't pay them the minimum wages. And they said, Dina de Machlusa doesn't apply because all the parties involved are Jewish. Rav Henkin wrote a tshuva that's not correct. If the government makes chukim and mishpatim, so we have our own chukim and mishpatim. But if the government made litikin ha'olam, that people shouldn't rip each other off, they shouldn't skin each other alive. So that the Rabbanim should have made such a din. If the Rabbanim are not making, so that's binding. The government makes such a law, it's binding on the Jews as well. So there are a few exceptions to the rule where the Dina de Machlusa is binding, even though all the parties involved are Jewish. So the Shach writes a few more exceptions to the rule. When is Dina de Machlusa binding, even though all the parties involved are Jewish? So the Shach writes, one, he quotes from the Mordechai, so he's interpreting. If you have a situation where the halacha has nothing to say about the case, then Dina de Machlusa is binding. Where do you have a case where the halacha has nothing to say? Corporations. You bought online, you bought on the internet, whatever. The halacha has nothing to say. So the Chazon Ish quotes that Shach and he says, what do you mean? With all due respect, there doesn't exist a case. The halacha has what to say on every case. Either the halacha says kana or loy kana. The halacha says chayiv apater. There is no case where the halacha has nothing to say. So that's he liked that Chazon Ish because he came to that realization. This professor Jacobson came to that realization on his own. That in secular law, it's man-made, so it doesn't cover all the cases. You can draw up a contract which will not be covered with any law at all. But the halacha was given in Hashemayim, and it covers every single case. So that's, he was not bothered. He was not bothered by that. There's a Mishnah in Kelayim that everybody talks about. Adnei HaSodeh. Mishnah talks about human beings that are growing from the ground. Sounds like they're attached to the ground. So such an animal doesn't exist. It's a mythical animal. You look in, I looked this morning in Jastrow. In the dictionary, so he writes, it's a mythical, it's from a mythical animal that the Greeks made up. So how did that item talk about an animal that never existed? So this professor said that doesn't bother him. The Gemara talks, he may yet make such an animal. It may yet come up. They don't have to talk about what exists. They have to cover all the cases, even what's going to come in the future. In fact, I remember many years ago, Meir Schlesinger was the founding Rosh Yeshiva and Yeshiva in Shalavim. So they send boys to the army there. The Israelis go to the army. They send boys from Chutz Loris also to the army. So the year after Melchemet Yom HaKippurim, so he invited all of the Hezda boys to visit the Yeshiva Shalavim and Chalamayt Sukkis, that they should discuss all of the shadas that came up during the Melchama. Different shadas came up. So he told me that, I think they were there for 2 days, and he asked everyone to write down all the shadas, and they're going to research them. They're going to look in Shulchan Aruch. All the shadas were from Arachayim. So he gave me a dugma that they had a shayla. There were 10 boys together, but half of them were on one side of the Suez Canal, half on the other side of the Suez Canal. The shayla whether they mitzvurf to a minyan. It's close enough to see each other, to hear each other. That was one shayla. Then he said, a shayla, some of the boys are inside a cave, some are outside of the cave. So the shayla about Kiyo Shofar in the cave. So the klalim and the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch about this. So he says, they wrote down all the shaylas that came up. And then they were all doing the research, and he said, over 85% of the shaylas they found explicitly in the Mishnah Berurah. But when we study Mishnah Berurah, we think that's never going to come up, so we skim over that. You run through it, you don't even spend any time on it. But when the shayla came up and they started looking it up, over 85% of the shaylas were explicit in the Mishnah Berurah. And the other 15% that were not Mishnah Berurah, they scratched a little below the surface, they found it in the Gemara. The Gemara had all the rest. The Poskim had all the rest of the case. The Halacha covers all the cases. Everything is covered. The Gemara talks about a gigantic bird that was a Bar Yochni that was flying in the air, and it laid an egg, and the egg fell down on the earth, and 60 communities drowned in the liquid of the egg. So it doesn't exist such a... How could there be such a big bird that can lay such a gigantic egg? So no one knows what the Gemara is talking about. Yeah, but a lot of times, agaritas, we don't understand Mechalav. What are they talking about? They're talking about nonsensical things that are impossible. So Rabbi Sol Salanter commented on that Gemara. Rabbi Sol Salanter traveled specially to Paris. He knew that many university students were Jewish. And he felt that they were on the bottom already, the lowest rung of furthest away from religion. So he wanted to start, they already went to the rock bottom, so he wanted to get them back into Judaism. So he didn't speak French. They had other people, he organized shiurim, that the university students should learn Torah and come back to Shmiras HaMitzvahs. So there's some kind of a war during his lifetime. So they had headlines in the newspaper. At that time, the practice used to be that the king of a country or whatever, the prime minister, would dip the pen in a bottle of ink, and he would sign a declaration of war. So they had in the headlines of the newspaper, after the first day of war, something to the effect, 10,000 people drown in one drop of ink. And they explained in the article, they used one drop of ink to sign the declaration of war. And the first day of war, 10,000 people were killed. So if you wait 100 years and you won't have the article, you just have the headlines, 10,000 people drown in one drop of ink. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. How can it happen? But when they printed it in the newspaper, everybody understood what it meant. You read the article and you understood. It was pshat. It wasn't drash. It wasn't that the headline was meant to give a hidden kavana, some Kabbalistic kavana. No, everybody understood the headline. You read the first... It was a catchy headline, a catchy title, but everybody read the article. It was Al Derech HaPshat. Rabbi Sol Salanter said, a lot of times the drushes that the Gemara quotes, they seem so strange. It's like the headlines in the newspaper. The people, the Rabbanim, gave the drusha to the Balabat. At the time, everybody understood what they were talking about. But now we live so many centuries later. We don't know what the whole background was. We don't know what they were alluding to. It's not that they were talking about something that never existed. The Gemara talks about mermaids. The Balabatim and that generation, they thought they were mermaids. So they would talk, when they would give a drasha, so they would talk about mermaids. They would give mishalim from things that people were familiar with. Doesn't necessarily mean that it actually existed. There is a problematic Gemara in Sukkah, the end of the second parak in Sukkah, the Gemara talks about a solar eclipse and a lunar eclipse. The Gemara says the non-Jewish nations use a solar calendar. So whenever there's a solar eclipse, that's a bad simon for the non-Jews, that some tragedy is going to occur. Whenever there's a lunar eclipse, that's a bad simon for the Jewish people, because our calendar is a lunar calendar. It's not exactly, the months are lunar and the year is solar. It's a hybrid, solar and lunar, but that's how the Gemara says. So the problem is, and the Gemara says, which are various which averes the people violate, that when Hashemayim they punish mankind with the solar eclipse or the lunar eclipse. What tells you which averes? So the problem is, what do you mean which averes? Anybody who knows enough mathematics and physics can predict in 1,000 or 5,000 years in advance. You can predict when there's going to be a solar eclipse or a lunar eclipse. That has to do with the way the Earth travels around the sun. Has nothing to do with anybody's averes. So the Maharal Prague points this out in the Sefer Be'er HaGoyla. So he says he doesn't think the Gemara thought that the solar eclipse was a punishment today because of what people, or the averes that people are doing. He says he thinks that Tanai must have known the secret also, that it has to do with the mathematical formula and physics and so on, where the Earth, the relationship between the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun, and so on. He says the Gemara was wondering, why did the Rabbanu Shalom create such an imperfect world that there should be such a thing as a solar eclipse and a lunar eclipse? Shouldn't the Rabbanu Shalom have created a perfect world? So he says, that's what the Gemara is saying. The Rabbanu Shalom knew that the people were going to be sinning, so that's why he created such a world that there should be eclipses. And the reason why he made this kind of eclipse is because they're doing these kind of aver. But it does mean that the eclipse today was because of someone did an aver. The Gemara is explaining what motivated the Rabbanu Shalom to create such a world that should be imperfect, that an eclipse should happen. That's his suggestion in the Gemara. The Chazon Ish deals with, all of the Poskim deal with Hilchos Treifos. That's what you raised before. The Gemara has an Eilu Treifos, the third Perek in Chulin. So we have certain diseases in the animals where the animal is declared as a Treifa. We usually assume a Treifa will not live for 12 months. And you have other sicknesses that the animal is not considered treif. So it doesn't correspond to what we know today. For example, the Mishnah says, if nitlu hakloyos, if the both kidneys are removed from the animal will live on. It's okay, the animal will live. How can the animal live? If nitlu hakloyos, it's missing the kidneys. So all the urine is going to be in the body. It's not going to be purified. An animal is certainly going to die. So some of the poskim suggest that maybe it's a misprint in the Mishnah. Maybe you should say nitla hakloya, one kidney was removed. But then they say, but no one has that girsa. In the Shulchan Aruch, nobody says that. Nitla hakloya, both kidneys were removed. So it doesn't make any sense. So that's what the other passages also in the Mishnah, it's quite a problem. So the Chazon Ish gives a suggestion. So part of the suggestion is reasonable and the rest is questionable. There is a passage in the Gemara where the Gemara says Rabbi Akiva was thought that it's possible that Bar Kochba is the Melech HaMashiach. And the other Tanoim disagreed with him. And they told him, it can't be. We have a tradition. He never heard of the tradition. They told Rabbi Akiva, we have a tradition that Shis Alfa Shnin Haviyama. The world is going to last for 6,000 years. The Rekech points out at the opening pasuk in Chumash, Bereishis Bar Elokim Es Hashamayim Es Haaretz, the letter Aleph appears 6 times, and Aleph is 1,000, Aleph is 1,000. So that's the reason why the 6 Alephin, because Shis Alephin Shin, the world is Bereishis Bar Elokim, the world as we know it is going to last for 6,000 years. Then the Gemara says the breakdown of the 6,000 years is the first 2,000 years is Tohu, nothing doing, people worshipping Avodah Zarah. Avraham Avinu was born in the year 1948, Libriyas Olam, if you calculate, then Bereishis. How old was Adam, Sheis, Enosh, Kenon, Mahalala, Yered, Chanoich? When you go to the generation, it says how old each one was when his son was born. So you just add up all the years. Avraham Avinu was born in the year 1948. Then the Gemara says we have a tradition when he reached the age of 52, that was the year 2000, that's when he started preaching monotheism in public. That's the beginning of 2,000 years of Torah. Before then, there was 2,000 years of Tohu, nothing doing religiously. And then 2,000 years of Torah, and the last 2,000 years, from the year 4,000 to the year 6,000, that's Yemos HaMashiach, possibility for Mashiach to come. So the Maharsha comments on this Gemara, this in the first parak in Avodah Zarah. So the Maharsha, around a few or so the Maharsha comments, what do you mean? It's only 2,000 years of Torah, and the Torah ends in the year 4,000? What about me? What about all the Amoraim? What about all the Rishonim? What about everybody? Everybody's still learning Torah. So the Maharsha says, no, it doesn't mean that the Torah ends in the year 4,000. The Torah began in the year 2000 when HaNefesh HaShirasa Becharim and Avraham Avinu is preaching monotheism and getting people to convert to the Jewish belief of monotheism. That's the beginning of Torah. And it goes to the end of the history of the world. The possibility for Mashiach to come is only in the last 2,000 years. So that's what the Gemara is bringing out. The Tanoim disagreed with Rabbi Akiva. It's not yet the year 4000, so it can't be. Bar Kochva cannot be in the Melech HaMashiach. It's not in accordance with the plan. It's only possibility that Mashiach can come in the last 2,000 years. But the Gemara didn't mean to say that the Torah is only restricted to the middle 2,000 years. So the Chazon Ish quotes this Maharsha, and then he thinks that it doesn't really fit in well into the Loshon HaGemara. The Gemara says the first 2,000 years was Tohu, nothing doing. The last 2,000 years is Yemos HaMashiach, so it's only possibility Mashiach should come then. Can't be Bar Kochva is Melech HaMashiach because he was before the year 4,000 in the Briya Zoran. The Gemara says the middle 2,000 years is Torah. So it sounds like each one is only 2,000 years. So it sounds like something ended in the year 4,000 of the Briya Zoran. What ended? What ended? So the Chazon Ish says, he's guessing, he does not. So he says, maybe what ended was until, from Maimon HaSinai until the year 4,000 of the Briya Zoran, the Chachmei HaTorah, the Chachmei HaMasorah had set up all the institutions of Halacha. All the concepts, Breire, Asmachta, whatever, you look at any encyclopedia, they set up all the ideas. And after the year 4000, maybe we can't set up new halachas. We have paskening, the Chazon Ish is also learning, the Rishonim, Acharonim, everybody's learning, but we're just juggling ideas that already existed before the year 4000. So that's the Chazon Ish's suggestion. So the Chazon Ish says, maybe since the Hilchas Treifas had to be set up in those 2,000 years, this is his suggestion, so they had to set it up according to the science of their time. Yeah, but if the science of their time was an error, so why is it binding? So he thinks that maybe Nishtanu HaTvoim, that's the questionable part. He thinks maybe in the days of the Tanaim, this science was so, and it changed over the years. And he has the same, that's in Yeridei, in Hilchus Treifus, then he has the same in Ebenezer, certain details of Tzvodaka and Krushovcha, where he writes the same. He said the Gemara gives a description of a certain organ of the male body that doesn't correspond to reality today. So he says, how did the Gemara say dinim? It doesn't correspond to reality. So he says, he heard from the doctors that maybe it changed over the course of the history of the world. In the days of the Tanaim, it was so. He's going a little bit along the lines, like he said before, a little bit like the Dor Revi. But the Dor Revi says, even though they made a mistake, after Father Yamin Shu smoked, since in their generation it was accepted that this is correct. Chazon Ish doesn't go like that. He thinks that maybe in their generation it was correct. If now we discover that they just made a mistake, they didn't know science at all, their science was incorrect, and the Chazon Ish would think that you have to back down. But he thinks maybe it changed over the years. So sometimes the halachas change when the mitzvahs changes. Sometimes the halachas don't change. So the Chazon Ish has this suggestion. Maybe the Tanaim set up the Hilchas Treifas during the 2,000 years of Shnei Halachim Torah. So once they set up the Dinim, so he suggests maybe you can't change it. That's questionable. There are many more Gemaras that the Gemara has a lot of other statements that seem to contradict what we know as science today. A lot of them are problematic. The age of the earth is a famous problem. You have based on carbon testing, we see that there are things that are much more than thick set, they're millions of years old. So how does this shtim with what it says in the Chumash? We get it, the Gemara has a shtim with the Chumash. So different suggestions are given on that. This is an old issue. So some say there is a medrash that says HaKadosh Baruch Hu was bari alamis u'machrivam. He created the world and he didn't like it. He destroyed it. Then he created the second world. He destroyed that. He created the third world. And each time he built a new world on top of the old world. So maybe all of these old dinosaurs that are millions of years old, maybe this is one of the earlier Mahaduras. Maybe it wasn't from this Mahadura, the last Mahadura of the world as we know it. Maybe this one from the earlier Mahaduras. That's one suggestion. Another suggestion that they give is little less reasonable. Now the suggestion that some of the Svarim write is that the Gemara says when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam HaRishon, when a baby is born, he's a one-day-old baby, so he has to have a mother to take care of him. If he creates Adam HaRishon like a one-day-old baby, so who's going to take care of him? So he created Adam HaRishon as a fully grown man. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the trees, they weren't created like a tree that's going to take a couple of years till it grows up. He created big fat trees with thick trunks and so on. Everything was created bits of yoinam. Fully grown. All the animals were created fully grown. So that's what some suggest. Maybe the Rebbeinu created all the animals fully grown, millions of years old. That's a little less reasonable than the first suggestion. Then others suggest that the Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim that we don't really know The Gemara says we're not supposed to investigate into anything before Yom HaShishi by Chul HaShemayim Horatz V'chol Tzvom. Before Adam HaRishon was created, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not yet a melech. The pasuk says in Mishlei, Kvod Elikim Hester Dover, Kvod Malach Machagor Dover. So it's the kavod of the melech. A melech means one who has a nation. So it's the kavod of the melech if you investigate all the details. So when HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam HaRishon, then he became a melech. Ein melech b'layom. How do we say Adon Olam Hashem? When the Barsham created Adam HaRishon, then he became a melech. So up until Yom HaShishi, up until the time Adam HaRishon was created, he was only Elakim. So the Medrash says, Kvod Elakim Hester Dovor, that's the Medrash Rabban on Baichulu. And the Gemara Chagiga in the second parak says, you're not allowed to investigate Malafonim. What was before Adam HaRishon was created? Pasuk says in Chumash, Ki shalna liyamim rishanim shahayu lefechan b'neyam shebara Hashem odam al ha'adoma. You're supposed to investigate from the time God created us. You're not supposed to investigate before. So the Rambam writes in Moreh Nevuchim, and many Mekubalim accept this from the Moreh Nevuchim, that when it says the Sheishes Mei Breishes, Yom Rishon, Yom Echad, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, it doesn't necessarily mean a day of 24 hours. So that's what they say. Maybe the days meant something else. After Adam HaRishon was created, so then we assume Teva functioned the way we know it today. We're not supposed to investigate before. These are some of the issues that are discussed. There are more issues that have to be worked on, but some other time. A good tevach.
Can we use DNA evidence for paternity? Yeah.
Fear of Adai.
What about
Shulitz for the Agunas in 9/11? Every tshuva had all pilpul, and the last paragraph was, "Well, befrat that we found the DNA of the person, so we know he's dead." So you didn't need the whole pilpul. DNA is a tin and move.
What about the child that was revived by Elisha? Was the child dead, or was it CPR?
The Rambam in the Gemara of the Ruchim says that it was CPR, and the Gemara says not so. The Gemara says that Elisha requested pishnayim, twice as great koach hanevuah as Eliyahu Hanavi. The Gemara says, where did he get double koach hanevuah? Eliyahu Hanavi was mechayev one mace, and Elisha was mechayev two mace. So the Gemara says it was not CPR. The Gemara says that he brought him back from the dead, and the Rambam right said it was CPR.
Do you eat fish when the meat?
No, my wife doesn't serve it. My wife puts two forks.
If I will serve it, you.
I should. I eat all the other fat people. I eat all the other unhealthy food. The other unhealthy food are bad.